Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Russell Hsiao. I am the executive director here at the Global Taiwan Institute. GTI is a 501c3 think tank dedicated exclusively to Taiwan policy research. We're very pleased to present to you all of these programs that I'm glad to see this great participation in and welcome you in the new Lunar New Year. In pursuit of our objective of strengthening U.S.-Taiwan relations, we organize a number of programs here. One is a weekly newsletter called the Global Taiwan Brief. If you aren't already subscribed to receive it, please go on our website. It's www.globaltaiwan.org, where we invite contributing analysts, scholars, emerging scholars to focus on Taiwan and policy-relevant issues to Taiwan. Our second major program, which you are here participating in, is our public seminar series. And here we try to invite leading scholars, practitioners, to talk about Asia and more specifically about Taiwan. And we're really pleased to be able to have Bisha here today to as a participant and speaker of this program. Our third major program, which we are in the course of planning, is our annual symposium, which is a flagship of our events, and we are planning it for some time later this year, where we'll assess U.S. policy options towards Taiwan and do so on a systematic basis to create some metrics by which to determine the health and future of relations. So today's event is a special one. Asia has been the hallmark of the former Obama administration's foreign policy, and highlighted as a bright spot in an otherwise bleak and conflict-prone world. The basic narrative follows that Asia is on an inevitable rise and the United States needs to be in on the ride and help shape that future. But there's another narrative. Far from being in a cohesive powerhouse, Asia is a fractured region threatened by stagnation and instability. The end of the Asian century provides a comprehensive account of the economic, military, political, and demographic rifts that bedevil the Indo-Pacific, which accounts for half of the world. All is not lost. According to the author of this just-published book that we will hear from today, Asia, working with the United States, has a unique opportunity to avert catastrophe, but only if it acts boldly. Misha Auslin, the author, is a resident scholar and the director of Japan Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, where he specializes in Asian regional security and political issues. Before joining AEI, Dr. Auslin was an associate professor of history at Yale University. He's also a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, the National Review. His books include Pacific Cosmopolitans, A Cultural History of U.S.-Japan Relations, and he has advised both the U.S. government and private businesses on Asian and global security issues. So we're very honored and pleased that he is here today. Before I begin, I also want to acknowledge a few of our very distinguished guests in the room, including our board of directors, our vice chairman, Jennifer Hu, as well as our advisory council members, Dr. David Tsai, Dr. Chen Wenyan, and last but not least, obviously our incredible staff here that that makes our events possible. And so really, thank you. And really, they are the one who deserves the round of applause for the work that we do here. So to begin, we're trying this in a new sort of format in terms of having a book talk because there's just so much literature out there, about Asia now. But it's hard to find really a good one. And if there is one that if testimonials from high senior ranking officials is a one demonstration of really the substance and impact that a book has, I think it's very hard to find another book that has as many praise heaped upon it than in Misha's book. So we're very pleased to have him here, and I hope that you'll also, when on your way out afterwards, to purchase a copy of the book. And Misha has also graciously offered to sign those books afterwards. So thank you, Misha. And so for today's discussion, which is unconventional in the sense that we have only had Misha here to discuss, I will present a few questions that I hope Misha can, in the time that we only have, to discuss some of the things that that really stands out from this book. And so Misha, I think the first thing that really caught my attention is the title of your book. So as a professional focused on Asia policy, I believe we're all invested in believe that Asia is the most critical region, the most important for U.S. policy. And so my reaction was kind of disbelief that, Misha, you would write something that sounds so provocative about, you know, how perhaps like it's at the end of the Asian century. So how did you come up with this title?
Well, first, before I begin, let me thank you, Russell, for having me here today in the Global Taiwan Institute. I'm sorry, Russell said that they tried to invite leading scholars. All you could get today was me. But I am glad that you all came out. I appreciate it on a cold and blustery day. It means a lot to me to give. This is only my second talk in D.C. on the book, and I've been traveling actually the past 3 weeks, over 3 weeks, to a lot of different places, including in Europe, and just came from California yesterday. So it's actually nice to be home and back to sort of where, you know, a lot of the rubber hits the road when we actually are talking about what are we going to do with Asia. Let me also say before I get into your question, congratulations on GTI. I mean, I think this is a long overdue and needed addition to the DC think tank ecosystem, but not only a needed addition, an excellent addition. And you guys really should be congratulated over and over for what you're doing to raise attention to the broader set of issues, give a different perspective and a different angle, because we've become sort of very monofocused on the way we approach Asia. You know, whether it's just we're looking at the China lens or we're looking at the Japan lens or whatever it happens to be, it's actually shocking that we haven't had a group focusing on Taiwan, a vibrant democracy in the region. And so, you know, wishing you guys all the luck as you go forward, and an honor to be here in one of your early events. Of course, if the title of my book is right, it may be one of the last events too, you know, because it's the end of the Asian century. So, you know, eat up and enjoy. So the title, yeah, I definitely wanted the most boring title possible for the book. I wanted no one to be interested in it. Like, it's interesting because I think I could talk about it more here than I can when I'm outside. You know, it started off as a think tank report, in essence. We all know those. We all know that we don't read those. We all know that they come out pouring like the rain in a waterfall, and, you know, if you're lucky, one or two maybe strike. Strike gold, but I was going to do something like that, and actually I was going to do a book completely different from this. I was going to do a book that not only reiterated, but I thought maybe did the common wisdom one step better, which was I was going to make an argument that the American future had to be an Asian one. That just as all of the pundits were predicting about Asia's inexorable rise or the inevitable shift of power from west to east, that we, in our own calculation of what was in America's interest, needed to discard or jettison our Atlanticist DNA. We had to get out of the Middle East because it was going nowhere for us, you know, just try to cap it off and you know, get extracted from it, in essence, and embrace the Pacific within us. That this is where the opportunity really lay. So I was, you know, going to go over and do a book that would have been in line with people like Martin Jacques, When China Rules the World, or Kishore Mahbubani, I forget the title of his many books about the shift of power, or sort of Fareed Zakaria type book. So I went over to Asia. Obviously, I've been dealing with Asia, and particularly Japan, but all of Asia for 25 years, and was just going to go over and gather the evidence I needed to write the book that I already knew I wanted to write. And then something strange, something funny happened on the way to the forum, which was that as I was going through Asia, talking to everyone from heads of state down to, yes, the Tom Friedman cab drivers, people started talking to me about the problems and the fears that they were encountering. And more specifically, they were saying to me, these are the things that you guys in America aren't paying attention to. And so, of course, I resisted it because that wasn't the book I wanted to write. And then after a while, I realized, as the old radio commentator Paul Harvey used to say, this was the rest of the story. That there was another side of Asia to talk about that didn't deny or ignore it. I was not interested in alternative facts. I was not thinking that, you know, I'm going to deny that Shanghai really has incredibly huge, beautiful buildings. Instead, I wanted to suddenly capture this sense of fragility that I was finding wherever I went, that people were frustrated, they were worried, they were concerned, and they were deeply, deeply concerned that we in the United States were not taking these things seriously enough. Now, I say that, by the way, that this was started in like 2010 when I began this. It took a very long time to do the book just because, you know, you have that leisure. This was before the South China Sea. This was before, really, the major dust-up in the East China Sea. This was before the Chinese stock market collapsed. This was before the new normal. This was before all of that stuff. So I struggled with what seemed to be a very counterintuitive narrative about what was going on in Asia, but the more I looked at it, the more fascinating it became. So ultimately, that's what I decided to do, and we came up with this somewhat lurid clickbait title, The End of the Asian Century, not because it's predictive, but because I was trying to capture the idea that our presumptions, our assumptions about what Asia would be in a very fraught and dangerous world, i.e. that this was really the only place where you were going to have opportunity, may not be the case. An analysis and a diagnosis of what could derail Asia's future, and that's ultimately what we came up with.
Now, I want to follow up on an excellent sort of observation that you made, and that is really pointing out to this new normal that we're in, and then, you know, and I think everyone should be, you know, should buy a copy of this book, but, you know, I mean, to give a reader a sense,
or two. What,
or send them more
just
senses,
in, just
right?
in case you, know, you lose one.
But without actually, like, you know, giving away everything here, you know, tell them, get them to get a sense of what they're in store for. What are some of the major premises and key takeaways?
Give me a second. Okay.
There we go. So this is the big new secret thing. This was the you know, Area 51 under wraps element of the book, which was ultimately this became a book about risk, about trying to identify and analyze risk, understand it, and then figure out what might you do about it. The question for me was, well, how do you actually conceptualize risk? How do you articulate it? You could go country by country, which is, you know, a tried and true way. It's a little bit boring to me. You could take just a few major issues and say these represent risk. But after a while of thinking, I thought, you know, always when I start talks on Asia, I got to put up a map, because a lot of, not you guys obviously, but a lot of Americans, they don't even know what Asia looks like, right? They sort of know where it is on the globe, but, you know, if you're talking about what are the shapes of the countries and the like, they don't know. So I was thinking, well, if I always have to do a geographic map of Asia, what would a risk map of Asia look like? If what you really were concerned with was mapping risk, how would you do it? And so went through tons of different ways of thinking about it. I'm not very good at these things, so luckily we have a lot of young, bright people at AEI and a lot of students who come through. And eventually we came up with this Lord of the Rings-style fantasy map that you see the little ship up there right in the corner, right? So if you were sailing to this continent of Risk Asia and you were about to map it, like Skull Island and finding King Kong, what would you encounter? And I came up with five regions of broad risk, and those are the five chapters of the book. And they start up there in that region in the north, northwest, the failure of economic reform, which really goes to the heart of our narrative about Asia, that this is a land of endless opportunity, and if it passes from one country like Japan, another country will pick up the baton like China. But it looks at the ways in which Asia's high-flying golden days of economic growth may well be over, and I would arguably, I think, are over. It then shifts to that region in the middle of demographics, what I call the Goldilocks dilemma of either too many people or too few people, but very rarely just the right amount of people. And again, oh, and I'm sorry, I should have backed up one step and say, what is Asia? Because we all have different definitions of Asia, I apologize. Asia for me is India up to Japan. That's the area covered in this book. With great humility, I decided to take India up to Japan. So right, more than half the world's population, 40% of global output, the world's largest countries, nuclear powers, largest militaries, so on and so forth. So that is that great dynamic arc that swings up from India through archipelagic, continental, and peninsular Asia up to Japan and even Siberian Russia. So when you talk about these issues, economics, demographics, and the other ones I mentioned, it's incorporating all of those countries. So big countries, small countries, nation states, sprawling empires, countries that are democratic, autocratic, and totalitarian, and everything in between. So the regions are meta-regions, and within that, it's recognizing the differences within them. So the demographics, just to give you obviously a common sense introduction on that angle, is, you know, you have Japan, which is already losing people, but is a wealthy country, so it's able to manage that loss, at least for now, better than might otherwise be expected. That's going to happen in South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong, most of the developed societies. On the other hand, you have China because of the One China, mainland China because of the One China policy, also heading into a demographics leveling off and slowdown around 2030, but per capita not a very wealthy nation, with government capacity less able to answer what will be increasing demands on the part of a populace for entitlement, social services, and the like. On the other side of the ledger, you have countries with too many people, India, Indonesia, Vietnam, young countries, where again, the greatest single driver will be demands on the government for jobs, opportunity, education, infrastructure, and the like. So this demographic dilemma, which I think in DC we pay way too little attention to, in many ways will be the single most important driver of government policy in the coming generation. And again, whether you have too many people or too few people, whether you're a democracy or an autocracy, watch the demographics. It's as in a real map. The border regions are contested. They spill over into each other. So the demands of an aging or a rising populace on the economic side is just as great as it is on the political side. And that's the third region, politics. Unfinished Political Revolutions, which is a somewhat counterintuitive title, but it really tries to get at the question of the fragility of many of these political systems. Again, I'm not predicting revolution, but just saying that there is a much more contestation internally for many of these regimes than we pay attention to. I think China, the case is very clear. I think a lot of that is what is the reason for the crackdown that Xi Jinping has on civil society. 200,000 odd protests a year, we know about that. But look at South Korea. A million people in the streets in December demanding the removal of Park Geun-hye, not just because she had a friend doing a pay-for-play bribery scandal, but because young South Koreans no longer believe in the future of their system. It's what they call Hell Korea, or Hell Joseon, the old name for Korea, the imperial name. Hell Korea. Rising income inequality, lack of job opportunities, incredible personal indebtedness because of the emphasis placed on education. These are the things that poured South Koreans into the streets to protest a corrupt, what they consider to be a corrupt system. I don't believe Korea is going back to a military autocracy, but there are cracks and fragilities in that system we need to pay attention to. Corruption rife throughout Asia. Malaysia, Prime Minister Najib hanging on by a thread. Look at India, where repeated reform plans are frustrated. So the lack of political or the inability to have a stable politics in many of these nations. The last two chapters I'll mention very briefly take it out of what are meta issues, but looked at in a domestic perspective, and instead look at two region-wide sets of issues. The first one you see there in the East is the lack of political community, or what I call the why can't we get along problem. Part of our narrative of modernity is that as nations develop a middle class, hopefully liberalize, but as they modernize, trade with each other, globalize and the like, they form communities of interest that figure out problems within their region, try to resolve them and the like. Our template for this, of course, is post-war Europe. That is not happening in Asia. There are more institutions today, of course, for discussion than there were before, but nothing like a European Union or a NATO or anything like that. Instead, everything dealt with in Asia is on an ad hoc basis. A great example of this is the Rohingya crisis, the humanitarian crisis. It's been going on for years. And ASEAN, the most developed of all of the intra-Asian discussion and cooperation organizations, has washed its hands of the Rohingya crisis. So the Rohingyans are dying on boats. They're dying on the beaches. We're discovering mass graves because there is no ability collectively to solve regional problems. And then finally, that leads us into the last region, that little Cyprus-like looking island off the coast, which is the threat of war. That arguably, and again without being too lurid, arguably Asia is closer to some type of armed conflict today, whether through accident or miscalculation or deliberate policy, than it was 5 or 10 years ago. Again, running counter to our narrative that states should begin to resolve these problems and figure out that it's not worth it to fight over rocks and shoals in the South or East China Sea because of what's at stake. But instead, this is a region that collectively now spends more on defense than anywhere else in the world. It is a region where international law has proven signally incapable of resolving territorial disputes, i.e. the Hague and the South China Sea, and a region where you have coast guards, paramilitaries, and formal militaries facing off against each other increasingly. So again, it doesn't predict war, but it says that we should be moving in a different direction. So those are the five risk regions, the five chapters of the book, and of course it winds up with a set of solutions as to what we can do, some of which are OBE, overtaken by events, like Trans-Pacific Partnership, a full-throated defense of that. But that doesn't mean free trade is dead, and it doesn't mean that the U.S. alliance system is dead, as I think we've actually seen President Trump reiterate in recent days. So that's really sort of a capsule snapshot of the book.
That's great, and that's fantastic. And is there a reason why that threat of war is, you know, sort of a little island off the rest of the main factors?
You must ask our graphic designer who came up with it, and I didn't really catch it, but when I saw it, I thought, I guess that makes sense, because, you know, at the end of the day, war really is a separation. I'm not a Clausewitzian. It's not, you know, the continuation of politics by other means. War is a separation from everything that we take for granted in a globalized, rules-based world. It really should be its own separate island, because it's when everything breaks down. And it also has then the effect of changing everything. And so while I don't want to get too, you know, deep into the signification of it, I do like the fact that it, you know, it separates it off and says, if you get to this point, you've really failed on everything else, and we shouldn't be there. But unfortunately, we seem to be inching towards it, whether or not we actually get there.
As an organization focused on Taiwan, then, I mean, what we're most interested in here at GTI is Taiwan. And the book provides a risk map, as we have, as you artfully outlined here, and you point out how each country has also unique risk factors within the book. What, if any, risk factors are unique to Taiwan?
So, part of it, you know, what I should say is, in ways, this is a perfect DC book because it takes the 30,000-foot view. It is not a deep dive. You know, you can't, if you're taking this much territory and these many issues, you're not going on for 75 pages about any one thing, right? On the other side of the scale, you know, it's very much attempting to ensure that all of the important elements of Asia are represented in some way or another. There are parts I really don't talk about. The Mekong Valley gets incredibly short shrift, I mean, almost entirely. Central Asia is not part of the book. That's a sort of a definitional issue. But even places I wanted to talk about more, Mongolia and the like, they don't play a great role. Taiwan, there's a pretty significant section on it in the security chapter. And you could say, well, I mean, you could put it in the economics chapter, again, as we're talking about a vital economy, but one that's pressured in many ways. You could talk about it clearly in the politics chapter. I thought it fit best in the security chapter to look at the pressures on Taiwan that were coming from the mainland that would threaten these other achievements. And so that's really the perspective that I take. In the book, by the way, it's not reportage. I'm not my good friend Bob Kaplan, who does, you know, an unparalleled job of that. But there are a lot of anecdotes. You know, each section really starts off with sort of a vignette or a picture, or as they like to say, color. And so I tried to give that sense of, you know, talking about Taiwan sort of precariously perched off the mainland, and yet the odd fiction of pretending it's really not a nation when it is a nation. Clearly, the greatest threat is the security threat to Taiwan. That's obviously the one that I think is most affects American thinking. And as much as I tried to be an Asianist as I was writing the book, I'm an American, so I'm thinking always from an American perspective, right? I'm not a professor anymore, so I don't do that luxury of, you know, the impartial, you know, godlike observer above who doesn't have to take into account realities. I mean, we're Americans, you know, in terms of DC and thinking about this, and so Taiwan from that perspective starts as a security equation, but it doesn't end there. It ends with how do you ensure that this economy stays free and vibrant? The celebration of ECFA can also be something that in time can cause constraints on the Taiwanese economy as much as it gives opportunity. Clearly, the question of a free and open democratic system is one that we not only should be celebrating and talking about more in DC, but is one that we have to look at. Are there risks to it? And what would those risks be? Corruption, pressure from the mainland, looking at a number of those. The demographics I didn't look at specifically with Taiwan, but it is an issue for Taiwan. There is I think Taiwan has maybe the world's lowest birth rate, if I remember. I may be right on that. It's really close if it's not. I think it is. It's like the last number I thought I saw was something like 1.13. Don't quote me on that number, but it's extremely low. It's basically Korea and Taiwan vying for the world's lowest birth rate. Even Japan has ticked up a little bit. So this is going to be a major issue. That's why, looking at the demographics, Japan is your good leading indicator. As a basically mono-ethnic democracy, how is it dealing with these things? Taiwan and South Korea are actually able to really look at Japan very carefully because there's so much similarity, both the wealth, the national wealth, as well as the issues of how do we ensure that we don't change our cultures too much as we try to figure out how do we survive as a society. This is a very knotty problem, and Japan gets the attention because of you know, again, it's further down the road, but this will be an issue for Taiwan as well.
And in your book, you know, building on this with the econ side of it, is that you seem very bullish on Japan. You're also very bearish on China. What about Taiwan? You know, what do you think about, you know, the future economic prospects of Taiwan?
So Taiwan, I think, has that by far the heads, you know, it is a heads up, so to speak, on so many of the other nations that have not fully embraced, you know, a globalized economy or a globalized economic system. The pressure on Taiwan, of course, is always the China equation. You know, do you get too involved, too wrapped up with the mainland? Does that forego other opportunities? Or conversely, are there pressures that may be coming from the mainland? How do you maintain, in essence, what has been very hard for Taiwan politically to do, which is an international space? I would say, in this case, an international space economically. The trading rules, you know, essentially allow for more development along those lines, unlike, you know, the political equation where China says, yes, you can be in this international body or no, and everybody goes along with it. It's not quite like that. But Taiwan has the same problems that I think any aging, mature, open economy has, which is, what's next, really? You know, how do you ensure innovation? How do you ensure, and this goes a little bit to the demographics, maintaining a vibrant, educated workforce, a dynamic workforce, entrepreneurship, you know, ensuring that there is opportunity, but at the same time, and I think this is certainly the case with Japan, but in a lot of the Asian nations, stability along with it. It's a different model from ours, our sort of Wild West, anything goes model. Japan clearly did not choose that route. I think South Korea in some ways did not choose that route. What you see is less competition for more stability. It's a trade-off, and societies get to make those choices. In some ways, I think it's been very successful. I think Taiwan faces some of those same issues. But as a relatively small nation with an aging population, or what will be an aging population, these are really acute questions. The question of innovation, the question of next generation development, how do you maintain that and ensure that? And I don't think it needs to be a single country solution. What I would love to see, for example, is Japan really take a leadership role in, first of all, acknowledging, as I think it does overall, but acknowledging and addressing all these problems, and then reaching out to its fellow democratic states, especially the aging ones, and say, okay, what are the best practices that we get from this? What are the things that we can be doing together? These are societies that have great commonalities as much as they have great differences. And I'd love to see Taiwan and South Korea and Japan be talking openly, and, you know, bring Singapore in as well, a little bit different, but also an aging society, and talk about these issues. That, I think, is really, and it's also a way for Taiwan, I think, potentially to play a leadership role. Because it's something you can't, you know, you can dash up upon the rocks of, well, democracy versus not. The aging and economic issues are facts that cannot be ignored, and so you can, I think, have the ability to address them in an open regional or international forum in ways better than you can with other more contentious issues.
That's excellent. I mean, shifting gear now, I'm moving to like another risk factor, and I think we've covered the sort of the econ side, the sort of the lack of political community. I think maybe perhaps in one way here, now we're moving, I wanted to sort of address one of the strongest assets that Taiwan is often celebrated as, which is its democracy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was particularly struck when you discussed about how you felt like the Indo-Pacific was going to be the battleground for democracies. Mm. And so what do you mean by that, and how does Taiwan factor into that, you know, equation?
This is a great question, actually. I don't think anyone's asked me, and no one's asked me that question, actually, in all the book talks that I've done yet, so I really appreciate it. One slight clarification. I don't think I wrote that it was the battleground for democracy. I may have. I forget. I have to go back and look at which, you know, which article I used. But it certainly is a battleground for democracy, and that's very important. If you're my age, you were in college when there was this sort of sweeping tide of liberalism through the region in the 1980s, and a lot of us here remember it. We're working on, Chris was probably working on it on the Hill at the time. You know, you had the Philippines and the People Power. Even then, now, we're just cycling right back, you know. You know, you had the Philippines and Marcos, the Marcos overthrow. You had Taiwan, of course. You had South Korea. You had Indonesia. You had Mongolia. You had this sort of what seemed to be a sweeping tide of liberalization for a decade or so, roughly a decade, decade and a half, from the mid-80s to the late 90s and so. Whether or not people thought ultimately that's going to reach the mainland, this was part of that sort of Fukuyamian end of history thesis come to life. You know, this was part of the evidence for it, that liberal democracy clearly was going to win out everywhere. And that's obviously not the case. In fact, if you follow Larry Diamond at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, he talks today about a democracy deficit that we have in the world. And we see that in Asia. Certainly what we see is at least a slowdown in that democracy wave, probably almost a stasis in it, but there is regression. We have regression in Thailand. I would argue we have regression in Malaysia. I think there are questions about Indonesia. The one case, bright case that we all point to, Burma, Myanmar, actually is a much more contested case, I think, than we all recognize in terms of the continuing role of the military, the fact that this is just the beginning of a process, questions about Aung San Suu Kyi herself and her commitment to open democracy and the like. So that is not something that yet, I think, with all the great work and the great work that the Obama administration did and Derek Mitchell and others of our friends who worked incredibly hard at this, they're the first ones to tell you this isn't, we're not at the end. It's very Churchillian. We're not at the end. We're not at the beginning of the end. We are, however, at the end of the beginning, right? So we're beginning to move down the line in some of these. But it is a battleground. And clearly, if you took the liberal, the sort of neoliberal thesis of modernization to either an extreme or a more conservative degree, the hope was that we'd be getting closer to that in China, the mainland itself, eventually, right? As a polity and a society that would have understood that continued liberalization and opening up was in its own best interests. We saw it here in D.C. with a lot of the planning that we did, things that tried to normalize China, rightfully so, things like the WTO, but the SNED, Strategic and Economic Dialogue, all of these different things. In many cases in which we made choices between perhaps sometimes more forthrightly supporting our friends, like Taiwan, and hoping that we would get the big game right. I think there are very few people who believe today that that's the path we're going on in China, that what Xi Jinping has done is really done a U-turn. It's not a J-turn. As the Japanese call it, a J-turn, right? So it's not a full U-turn. We're not back to Maoist days. No one would pretend that. There are not going to be 50 million deaths in China. No one's saying that. But it's sort of a J-turn where you've gone back partway. Economically, the size of the state-owned sector is more important than before. And we've just had reports on the further squeezing of private construction and favoring state-owned enterprises and the like. Clearly, politically, this crackdown on civil society is real and it's enduring. And all of us here talk to our friends from the mainland who say that it's a worse time than it has been in 25 years, probably since Tiananmen, over 25 years now. Can it change tomorrow? Sure, but this is the path we're on right now. So that question about the battlefield for democracy is one that we were sort of confident, if not, we wouldn't be winning, at least we'd be holding and probably inching forward, inch by inch along the beaches. I think today we at best have the beachhead. And what we have to do is ensure that we don't lose more of it. That's why things like South Korea and overall, I would say, cynicism in Japan worry me, not because they're not going to be democracies, but because they're less effective democracies. They're less effective at making the case as to why democracy is a good thing. We're 240 years here, and we're still struggling with it. So it's crazy to think that after a generation or two, you're going to have it perfected in Asia. But we need to be making the case. They need to be making the case through word and deed that, yeah, this is the way to go. And you want to be getting there eventually. So I'm worried about, you know, South Korea, where we go. I'm worried about Japan. There's a lot of cynicism. There's a lot of voters who've just sort of opted out of the process. I think in Taiwan, you haven't had that yet. But as you sort of continue this negotiation with the mainland, and you sort of have to figure out where will we be in a generation, what do we want to be as a nation in a generation, there will be questions about the continued validity of this system going forward, just as there is in Hong Kong, as the Hong Kongers try to figure out where they go, and other areas.
And now taking it from more of the granular level and taking a step back and really asking sort of the million-dollar question here, and that is, you know, what are the implications of your book's thesis for U.S. policy towards Asia and Taiwan specifically?
So that really gets to the last chapter. I learned you got to put one of those last chapters in the book. I didn't want to have one of those chapters because, you know, the truth is that I know that's what we do here, right? We're a policy. That's what we do in D.C. The only reason here is because we do policy. And yet, you know, one man's policy is another man's idiocy, essentially, right? I mean, this is my policy. You could look at it and go, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Here's my policy. You know, I want 45 American aircraft carriers in Asia. Like, okay, great. How are you going to get there? And, you know, my friends at other places will say, I'm closing up the bases tomorrow, and I'm ripping up the free trade agreements, and we're coming home. And, you know, so policy to me, it should be a negotiation. It's more sort of laid out as this is what, you know, is... So I didn't even want to have a policy section, but I did. And so my policy section was oddly, this doesn't mean by the book, but my policy section oddly was, we've actually been doing a lot of the right stuff. Is it now? Do I have to get closer?
Oh, no, I think Russell might be getting phone texts. Or, did you put it on airplane mode?
Oh, I'm okay. No, that's okay.
I mean, I can talk loud. I was a professor. I was used to projecting over to like 100 sleeping undergraduates. So don't worry. So what was I just saying? Where was I? I got the phone. So policy. But what part of it? There'd be
a chapter in policy.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, Chris guy. That's exactly right. That we were doing better. I need to be taking notes, right? I'll speak very slowly, Chris. So yeah, I mean, that was actually to me the point, which doesn't make for sort of a really dramatic, you know, this is what we've been doing wrong and here's how we have to save the world. The fact is, we've been doing a lot of the right things. Have we been doing enough of it? So a capacity, not a capability question, that may be one issue. Have we been very clear? And that's certainly an area where I criticized the Obama administration, I think others did, was sort of an ambiguity that seemed to lie in some cases at the heart of their policy. The question of emphasis, I've always argued, just because it seems to make sense to me, that you should start with friends and allies in Asia, partners, and then you work to China, as opposed to starting with China. Because I think if you start with China, it locks you into a set of circumstances, and that's okay. You know, these are things we should be arguing about. But I really did feel, and it's been very bipartisan. You know, people on both sides have been not that overall that far apart on Asia, and I hope it doesn't change that way. You know, I mean, it's much better to have what used to be, you know, what we saw in town, a much more robust bipartisan argument and discussion and, in fact, set of agreements. So I talked really about primarily three things that we've been doing, but I think we should be doing more. One was free trade and a full-throated defense of free trade. And I have to say, I'm a very agnostic free trader, not because I'm an economist and understand it, but because I look at the political results of these things. And I'm also a Midwesterner. So I know what free trade has done to the Midwest, to the communities I've lived in, where I came from, where people, a lot of the people I know came from. I'm not one of these, you know, free trade absolutists. But overall, I think there's no question that over time, free trade provides the best set of solutions. But you have to be smart at home. You can't have free trade abroad without smart policy at home. And we just assumed it was all going to work out. And that, unfortunately, has now made free trade suspect, so that Donald Trump can come and talk about why he doesn't like free trade, although he, to give him credit, he will talk about bilaterals. And if that's where he's at, that's what we have to push. He's talked about it with the UK. He's sort of hinted at it with Japan. I think we should be pushing that very much. But I like the idea of the TPP, not because it was a panacea, but because we were going to lose jobs from TPP. Those jobs were already gone. What it was going to do was make it easier to get beef to Japan and dairy to Japan and soybeans and a lot of these other places. It was actually going to provide more opportunities. And if any of you read that front page piece in the Wall Street Journal yesterday on the new death of the American farm and the family farm, this was something that was going to help with that. So I wanted to see it. But again, if that's not what we're going to get, we're going to get bilaterals, then push on the bilaterals. Don't let free trade die because TPP and TTIP are dead. Push on it and link these things together. And eventually you'll get to a different political regime which will want to embrace it. But don't let it wither on the vine. That's number one. Number two was the values question, which became very hard, I think, to argue after the 2000s in Iraq. It was the, are you imposing democracy, the freedom agenda. I think especially those on the conservative side felt sort of, well, some felt chastened about it, and others, you know, felt that, you know, nothing had changed and they were going to push it as hard as ever. When I talked about the values argument, I was coming again out of that period of the 80s and 90s where it seemed like democracy was on the march, and we should be encouraging that. That's, you know, it is part of who we are as a people. I don't think it supplant all American interests or it's the only thing you do, but you should encourage it. You should help it. I never understood quite why we didn't have sort of a grouping of democracies in Asia that we were trying to bring together. It's not the only thing we should be doing, but I remember when there was a sort of the, whatever they called it, the Union of Democracies or something, and Senator McCain shot down the idea. And I just didn't understand why we wouldn't try something like that as part of a set of tools. You know, people in government always talk about my toolbox. I have a lot of tools in the toolbox. Well, this was one tool they just thought didn't make sense, and I didn't understand that myself. So we should be doing it, not imposing it, but encouraging those who are trying to figure out this very messy path and working with them. And I think Taiwan plays a major role there in showing how you can have this transition and do it very successfully. South Korea, same thing. So that was the second thing, is to, yeah, we should be thinking about a community of democracies, not as the only way we engage with Asia, but as a way that we engage with Asia. And I still think it's valuable. Or certainly we should try it. If it doesn't work, drop it. But don't not try it. And then the third thing, of course, is the one thing we in D.C. love to talk about, which is the military presence. You know, that's the thing we ultimately come down to, and that is important. I can't prove the negative that if the United States had not had its set of alliances and military presence for the past 70 years, that Asia would be a war-torn, impoverished region. I can't prove that. What I can, as a historian, say, though, is that because we had our set of military alliances and military engagement, security engagement in the region, we have the Asia of today. I mean, it's just there. It's a fact. And clearly our participation in that is part of that fact. So the idea that we could, just as the libertarian friends say, just withdraw and everything will be the same, or as my offshore balancing friends say, just come back home and when you need to go back in the region, to me it's a less persuasive argument. I get it. I understand it. But it's less persuasive politically because it sends messages that our friends increase their doubts over our commitment. But it also is something where the reality is, you know, when you're not there, it's harder to get back in, you know, just when the time comes. And clearly, I think all of us who travel to the region hear a lot of good things about our military presence. A lot of nations are happy to see American ships, to get the visits from the dentist ships, to see the C-17s come in, to know that, you know, if you have a devastating tsunami or earthquake or both, man, the USS Ronald Reagan is going to be there with potable water and blankets and medical supplies. We should be incredibly proud of that. I mean, amazingly proud of that. No one else does it to that level. But that's a military function, not solely, but extraordinarily so. The commitments that we have made that have allowed people at least to take a bet on trying to maintain their own way of life, whether it's South Korea, where we've had 27,000, 28,000 plus troops there for 60 years, whether it's Japan or places that say, look, I know they're going to visit. These are important elements of stability. The one thing I learned is that people don't like instability and uncertainty. I'm not talking war, just uncertainty that leads to instability. They don't like that. Stability is important. We provide it. We don't always have to be firing off the guns, but we have played a unique role in helping to maintain stability, and I think we should continue to do it.
Asia, thank you so much for that excellent tour of your book. And before I open it up for questions, I did want to sort of bring the discussion to some current developments. I wanted to get your sort of reactions to them, and I'm sure that you probably already know what I want to ask you, especially with President Trump when he was president-elect, broke with past conventions and set a new one by taking a phone call from the democratically elected president of Taiwan. And just last week, Trump called President Xi. What is your take on President Trump's statement and his policy towards Taiwan and China?
So like everyone, I think, you know, we're still trying to figure it out. You know, it feels like a very long month. It's only been a month. Not even yet, right? This is the 13th, right? We're not even at the 20th. So it feels like a very long month. It's 3 weeks because there's been a lot of churn, obviously. You know, self-inflicted wounds, but things that are actually quite interesting if you look at whether you like it or not, what will be an emerging worldview for the next 4 years. So I think it's incumbent upon us to take it seriously, take it at face value. I'm less persuaded now by the arguments that they have no idea what they're doing and they're swinging back and forth. And he took this call without planning from Tsai Ing-wen, and now he just capitulated to Xi Jinping. It's entirely possible. I don't think so. I think he you know, if you look at who he is, and again, this is, you know, psychoanalysis that we should never do, but look, he's someone who's a negotiator and who proudly talks about that and always starts with a maximalist position. He throws things on the table and then works down to a workable, acceptable, not a workable, an acceptable solution for him and assumably the other party. I think there is so much more that we should be doing to support Taiwan, and we should have been doing it for a long time. Do you do it carefully and in a deliberate manner? Yes. Should you have a full review? Absolutely. Do you do it in a tweet? No. Do you do it in a phone call? Probably not. But the question that it should have just been status quo forever over Taiwan, I don't think so. So I give them credit for saying, we're going to think more carefully about how we deal with Taiwan. We should be doing that. What they need, though, and Chris is someone who's been writing about this daily, is they need a team. They don't have the full team in place. So for us, the sort of policy wonks, we're sitting there going, well, you can't do it without us, and you can't do it without your team. But, you know, to some degree, that's true. You have to have all of the experts who have all the different opinions coming in, talking about what's wrong with the policy, what do you want to do, and then what are the implications. And then if you want to change everything, that's your prerogative. If you're wrong, we'll live with the consequences. But do it under a labored way. What I think he did in the Xi phone call was buy himself time. And I think that's what the Mattis visit did as well. And it sent two messages. Let me talk about the Mattis visit for 1 second, and then Xi, and then I'll end. The Mattis visit answered two questions for people. The first was, are you bugging out of Asia? Right? Are you ripping up the alliances, walking away? You did it with TPP. Are you out of Asia? And his answer was no. He recommitted firmly to both Japan and South Korea, and stated that this was going to be a priority, in essence. It was his first trip, so it was a priority. On the other hand, to those who said they're about to get us into a shooting war with China, he said no. Mattis did. He said, I don't think we need to do much more right now in the South China Sea. We're doing what we need to be doing. We just need to make sure we do it and give diplomacy every opportunity. He capped off the fears of people on both sides, and I think bought time to come up with a more comprehensive policy. And again, maybe I'm just an inveterate optimist, which is not really what you take from conservatives. We're supposed to be pessimistic, but my interpretation of it is that they figured out they needed to buy themselves time. They had gone too far too quickly. And the president did the same thing. He reiterated our commitments to the Senkakus. He's talked about the commitment to South Korea. He has not said he is not going to be supporting Taiwan more, but in the phone call, and it's interesting, by the way, for those of you who like to parse these meanings or these nuances, the way the White House phrased it, which I think was neat, I don't know if it's right or not, they said President Xi requested President Trump to uphold the One China policy, and President Trump graciously agreed. There is a spin on it. It's an interesting spin that you could say is irrelevant, but in that case, so was Xi Jinping's the new model of great power relations. That was also irrelevant because it was just words. It's all in the jockeying for position and the phrasing. And it could be that Trump totally caved. On the other hand, he had to make Xi Jinping ask him to uphold the One China policy. I don't know. From a diplomatic perspective, I don't mind that. I don't mind him asking me. If he demands it, that's a different thing. And I don't mind granting it. Because what I've done is I've put it on the table. Xi Jinping and China are on notice, so to speak, that this can come back. And on notice that Trump didn't say, well, okay, you know, I've sold Taiwan out, I'm never going to talk to him again. No, I think you'll see, certainly with the people he has around him, probably a greater willingness to engage with Taiwan, which I think is the right thing. Again, the devil's in the details.
That's a great observation, and I would just add one qualifying point to the statement, the readout from the White House, and that is it emphasized our One China policy, and I think that's also an operative word right there to indicate that, yeah, the U.S. One China policy, which is very different from the PRC's One China principle, One China policy. So with that, I'd like to open up for questions. Please just state your name and also, and your question and your affiliation, if you can.
Thanks. Chris Nelson, Nelson Report, The Daily Scribble. I know we're short of time, so a great talk. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I'm actually going to buy the damn book. How about that?
Well, we should have gotten you a copy, but I'm happy you were.
Well, but why not? You don't get rich off these things. No.
Really? Oh, okay. I'm done, guys.
Yeah,
I'm going.
Sorry. Yeah.
Nice talking to you.
Redo your Amazon contract. You and I had this conversation, I know, when we went out to the first Tsai Ing-wen election, and that is, how do you help Taiwan without helping it too much, if you know what I mean. Taiwan has always been more in danger from its friends here in many ways than from the mainland, with a couple of exceptions, obviously. But you know, the zeal to help sometimes really gets out of hand. Right. And I'm wondering what your thinking is based on your travel for the level of support in Tokyo, especially for a more Trump administration focus on Taiwan than we got out of the Obama administration, and what things you would, you know, when the president calls you for advice, you know, what, what?
Did you read that letter?
Yeah, I know. Anyway, but with Pottinger, you know, I think we can have faith that, you know, this guy knows the score.
With
Matt Pottinger,
oh, yeah,
I think,
absolutely.
You know, he's smart, he's sensible. Yeah. The one question I have asked him is about this, and he said, we understand. So, what's your caution to the friends of Taiwan? You know, don't try to help so much that you end up really getting things in trouble.
Yeah, I think, Chris, that's really the debate. And we actually didn't, I did not go to the Tsai Ing-wen. We were there for Ma Ying-jeou, you and I. So this is a while ago. And I think, but it was the same question. Well, it was the same question because the question was, how close is he going to get? And you remember, we were there for the election, and in the last days, because DPP was very worried, they started running these commercials about the ECFA, right? And it was essentially China, literally it was like a cartoon of China swallowing Taiwan. That's what I remember very carefully, because it was the same issue. If he goes too far in that direction, what role do we have to play? And the same questions for Tsai Ing-wen, which he, you know, ricochet back too far. And I think that's a good point. You know, you're always trying to strike that balance. I think there has to be no question, though, that you maintain the commitment to helping Taiwan help itself. And I think that is where the concern, mostly in the Obama years, came up. I mean, they had to spend way too much time talking about F-16AB upgrades versus CD sales. You know, if you're down at that level of wonkishness and you're not working for Lockheed Martin, something's gone wrong. Right, you need to be, sorry, we have a former Lockheed guy here, I'm sorry. But, you know, you should be talking about bigger sort of principled issues than does your unwillingness to sell the most advanced F-16s mean that you're not supporting them, and then you're trying to make the case that, no, the AB upgrades are better. I mean, it's, like, that's not the debate you want to be having. So I think it does get to the rhetoric. So interestingly, Obama, and we all still continue to give him credit for it, the rhetoric of the pivot or the rebalance, whichever term of art you like, was very important. Rhetoric is important as a signaling device, as an articulation, as a framing mechanism. It can't be everything. So that if your rhetoric is not followed up in ways that seem materially to change the balance, then people will question your rhetoric. But rhetoric's important, and I think the rhetoric was missing on Taiwan. It was missing that we remained fully committed to this democracy. Not because of some agreement that was signed, you know, whatever, 40 years ago, or because Ronald Reagan put in a safe and, you know, his own understanding of the memorandum and so on and so forth, but because it's the right thing to do to support a democracy. And then we should be more willing than, I think, to... And here's where the policy sort of is. Anybody can come up with their own, but we should be more willing creatively to figure out ways that normalize Taiwan in the international sphere. I think we should be more willing to creatively think of ways to normalize Taiwan in the international sphere. Look, we made decisions that were bad decisions back in the 70s. There was no reason that we really should have accepted kicking Taiwan out of the United Nations. China was so weak back at the time that had we been willing to negotiate, we could have negotiated a better deal. Now, you know, I'm not an expert on that history, so all the implications of why and what the calculations down the road were, but we gave up a lot of maneuvering space down the road because of the eagerness to get China sort of on side early on without really giving ourselves the ability to not to backtrack, but to be more flexible. So I think that's where we are right now. I think we have to think about how do you norm Taiwan more without raising the ire of Beijing to a degree where it's going to materially try to hinder that. And I think it starts with rhetoric, but I think it starts with probably a pretty top-down review of all the areas that Taiwan is involved with and figuring out how you afford more opportunities. And I'd like to see Taiwan represented at more international meetings. They don't have to be, you know, necessarily the official track one ones, but the 1.5s. It should be a commonplace event that representatives of Taiwan are there talking about development, economics, politics, and security.
Okay.
I hope that answers it. I mean, because, you know, we could be in the weeds forever, but I'm talking about it, you know, for me, from sort of a framing mechanism. How do you approach it as opposed to here's my five things to do, you know? That's probably exactly right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They would not accept that. Yeah, you're right. You're right. You're right. Yeah, and they didn't want it. You're right. You're right. You're right. It's true. Yeah, I mean, that's a huge point of the contingency of history. Had we put more effort on it, could they have come around a different mindset in Taiwan? They didn't realize. They knew they were losing. They didn't realize just how much they'd be losing, right? So you could have maintained legitimate international space, which would have changed everything for the past 40 years. But they wanted, you know, they made the perfect the enemy of the good, and we can't afford to do that.
You didn't look at a
chat,
you said you're wrong.
It was not a good career. You could say it once, right?
Hello, Johnson Yuan, Huffolk Fellow at the National Endowment for Democracy. So you mentioned that Asia is having a lot of challenge and difficulty, but this kind of challenge is not unique in Asia context. For example, economically, the youth, the younger generations in Italy or Spain, they are also witnessing a down mobility, and also they have grievances to their futures. And in terms of their collaborative regional effort, the EU is at risk, mm-hmm. and countries are bailing out from international criminal tribunals in Africa. Right. And so what makes Asia so unique mm-hmm. for us to understand how it would affect the establishing world order? And my second question is, you mentioned that Japan can be a model, maybe a guiding mm-hmm. model to Asia. But you also mentioned that Asia is a diverse they have a lot of diversities in terms of social structures and also political institutions. So what makes you think that Japan as a Confucian model and also highly hierarchical social structure can apply on some other southeastern countries like Myanmar or Indonesia, which their political cleavage lies on religions and culture?
Okay, thank you. Two big questions. I see we have the NED section over here. So the first one was, no, it was not to claim that Asia was somehow unique, though I'll tell in a second why I think it's important and special, which are things we all know here. But it was to counter the common narrative that Asia was just on this linear trajectory upward. And, you know, if you just sort of wanted to drop Japan out of that, that's fine, because it's going to be China, and if not China, India, and if not India, Indonesia and Vietnam. I mean, my point was to say that these are problems we haven't paid attention to. Everybody knows the EU's problems. You know, we don't have to repeat them, right? People didn't, at least when I was starting the book, really pay attention to or know the problems in Asia. They just, it wasn't on CNN, it wasn't in the New York Times. Now, and that's why I'm very happy for the timing of the book, is that all this has, you know, broken through into the zeitgeist. And so I think it's the moment is ripe for this discussion. If I had published the book 3 to 4 years ago, which I could have, you know, just done a really quick slash and burn job and gotten it out, it would have made no sense. So now I think people go, oh, all right, there's a real change in China's economy. There really is the threat of some type of conflict in the South China Sea. So that's how I think the book hits the timing right. So it's not that I'm saying it's unique, but we do have to now pay attention to it. Why is it important, though? Obviously, because of the reason we all know. This is half the world. 40% of GDP. Look, we've been engaged in a series of wars in the Middle East for the past 16, 17 years now, almost 17 years, that overall have had very little impact, certainly on global equity markets. I mean, truthfully, it has not disrupted the global economy. We have problems with radical Islamism spreading and metastasizing into domestic economies, but for the most part, you don't have the conflagration of war spreading over borders. I mean, some parts of the Middle East. So we've been able to do that because overall, the Middle East is not as important globally as it is in terms of specifics within the Middle East, right? A war with China, that changes everything. That's not something you can say, well, we're gonna we're going to be duking it out for 5 or 15 years with China because we can't settle the South China Sea. That changes everything. That changes the modern world. It changes everything from supply chains and global equity markets to alliances to smaller nations being brought in to massive civilian casualties because of the level. I mean, in the Middle East, they don't have ballistic missiles or yet nuclear weapons, right? I mean, that they're using against each other. So if things, for whatever reason, spun entirely out of control, and that happens regularly throughout history, you know, we have the presumption of assuming it, or the luxury to presume it won't, that would change the world. So that, and again, the book is not saying, you know, the coming, you know, Armageddon, but it is saying we got a lot of problems that if we don't solve are going to get worse, or are likely to get worse, and if they do get worse, they would have really far-ranging impact, unlike what we've sort of become used to over the past, you know, over the past 15 years, which is we can dip in and out of the Middle East more or less at our leisure. A drone strike, a special op, that's fine. But the type of thing to really, if you really get something going at the South China Sea, no. So again, not predictive. And what was the second question? Yeah, I mean, it's more an aspiration of what Japan could do, and it's not that, you know, I was having an argument with, an argument over Asia, the definition of Asia, with a very well-known columnist who was saying, well, that's an idiotic definition of Asia. And I said, well, what's better? He said, you're Asia. All of it, you know, because, you know, either you divide it up into China, Japan, Korea, and then Southeast Asia, and then India, you know, which is the way we usually teach it at the universities, and Central Asia, or you include it all. And I said, well, you know, I think there are some commonalities, some ways from a policy perspective, and most importantly, from a U.S. perspective, we see it as a maritime region, though it's obviously continental, but it's a maritime region for us. And so we think of it linked by these seas, the IO, the Indian Ocean, South and East China Seas and Western Pacific all link together. So it's a way of getting at a set of questions. So Japan, you're right. I mean, what is Japan, a Confucian in some ways, more a Buddhist nation, have to say to a Muslim nation down in Southeast Asia? I think it has everything to say because we're talking about questions of modern development. And does that not mean there are not particularities? Of course there are, but if you're trying to figure out what's a modern educational system, or what is a, you know, how do you unleash the you know, entrepreneurial spirits? There's a lot, I think, that places like Japan, with their experience, can bring to the fore. Questions of civil rights, rule of law, all of it. Does it mean everyone's going to copy Japan? Of course not. But I think it does mean that the liberal nations in Asia should be taking the lead in at least raising the sets of questions for other nations to be talking about these things.
Well,
I don't know if that makes sense. Yeah.
I do want to give Misha a chance to, sign books that people purchase. So maybe leave one last question and make that.
Can I take like two really quick?
Of course.
Yes. I feel bad.
No, that'd be great. So thank you. Okay, so. Yeah, that's right.
That's
exactly. So two quick questions, and then and then we'll go.
So hi, my name is Louise Zhang. And speaking of Ned, I used to work with Ned on China. And I'm now a bilingual blogger. So a quick question. So over the last 5 to 8 years, there's been a surge of interest in China about Republican era history. And then in connection to that, more and more interest, fascination, and frankly, admiration of Taiwan. We're hearing a lot of Chinese civil society, intellectuals, and also ordinary people saying that Taiwan is the way that a rise in China should have looked like. Where if, you know, China had not chosen communism, had developed in a different way, that it would be much better, more prosperous, and culturally, you know, continuous. And so, you know, so I was wondering what your response to that would be, given you were saying, you know, the reason to support Taiwan, not just because it's a democracy, but also because it provides a living model of a possible outcome for China.
Sure.
And
Thank you. My name is Kenneth Gavin from Marconi Corporation. So my question is about the free trade. So what do you think about the TPP-11? I think it seems to me that it is better way to promote the free trade in the Asia region, because the other country like Taiwan can consider to join this TPP.
Yeah. So on TPP, look, not being a trade, you know, specialist, I can't say that, you know, with the U.S. out of it, it doesn't work because there are just benefits and scale that comes with the U.S. being in it. Clearly, it's optimal. Japan would like there to be the full TPP. They've made that clear. But Abe's also come around to reality, which is, you know, if I'm going to get a bilateral and that's what I can get, I'll look at that and then continue to move forward with TPP. So a TPP 11, sure. But I mean, as an American, I want America to be involved. So I'm inherently less interested in the TPP 11 than I am in either TPP or U.S. going out full with bilaterals, which of course are timely and difficult. So we'll see. But, you know, I don't also see why you can't have both. It's just not what you originally envisioned. And again, I think the political issue is the important one. Keep free trade alive. Don't let it die. And as for Taiwan as a model, I mean, I mentioned that a couple of times. I don't know the specifics you're talking about in terms of the mainland, but it's not particularly surprising to me that as people on the mainland worry about the future of civil society, see it being clamped down more, see the new restrictions on NGOs or the attempts to control VPNs so you can't have access to the internet and so on and so forth, that of course they look at alternatives where they don't have to worry about that. Does that mean Taiwan itself? Does it mean something else? I mean, there's a lot of different ways to approach liberalizing a society. You know, some bedrock principles. China's not there. So whether people on the mainland are actually looking at Taiwan per se, or they're just looking at a different environment which was less oppressive, it doesn't surprise me. The history question, I really don't know. I don't know if they're talking about we should have gone the Republican route. But I do think that you'll see more of this. And then just a final comment, and I think it is something where Taiwan, and I would argue Japan, may play larger roles in the coming years, which is as we begin to accept the new normal in China, which means a China of dramatically slower economic growth, one which is going to have some really significant political questions in the coming year, you know, with the Party Congress and where it goes forward. But as in essence we come around to the idea that China probably is not going to be the dominant country in the world anytime soon, that it has its own issues to work through and its own problems, then we will be better prepared or better situated to appreciate the alternatives that are there. Meaning in the 80s it was all about Japan, and as soon as the bubble broke in Japan, we thought we don't have to care about it anymore, so let's stop talking about it. Same thing with China. As long as China was growing at 10%, it was all about China. Now that China's slowing down, maybe we're going to get to the position where we can appreciate the strengths of societies like Taiwan or societies like Japan, their ability to balance over long periods of time economic growth with social stability, with some level of political responsiveness. I think, you know, more certainly in the case of Taiwan and Japan. And that's going to be good for us. It doesn't mean we ignore China, but we've spent 25 years ignoring Japan, and we've missed enormous changes in Japanese society that are very important, that I think a lot of Asian nations are looking at. We need to relook at Japan. And I think as China moderates in our own minds, we'll be better able to look at Taiwan, appreciate what it is, what it does. Same thing with Japan. And that's going to make us better at understanding Asia and coming up with policy that hopefully prevents the end of the Asian century.
Well, so, thank you. On that less pessimistic note than what the title of the book suggests, please join me in giving Michael Pinkett a round of applause.